the UCR Podcast.
All right, so I'm going to get right to it. We have friend of the podcast, UCR Scribe. You can call him many other things, some of them nice. But Gary Graff is here with us. And Gary, great to see you. Great to speak with you. We have a subject to talk about today that I'm going to get into here in a second. But I want to start by putting the spotlight on something that hit the internet yesterday. And that is, you took a big deep dive into the history of Renegade by Styx being used by the Pittsburgh Steelers. And obviously, tough night for Steelers fans last night, but that did not make me feel any less strongly about bringing this up, because I think that, I know I've talked to Tommy about the Renegade Steelers connection. Like, there's, it's something they have talked about, but you really got pretty forensic with the story and talked to a lot of folks. And I think that fellow Steelers fans, fellow Styx fans will dig taking a look at that. And, you know, how long ago did you start working on that?
And thank you for that. As I pull myself out of my Tuesday morning mourning for the Steelers here. It was only really a couple of weeks ago, but also because I knew the story. And, you know, like you had spoken with Tommy a lot about it. And the Steelers actually had produced a nice 10-minute mini documentary that you can find on their website about it. But there, you know, everybody nowadays has their fourth quarter, fourth quarter song, you know, whether it's Mr. Brightside, you know, up here at the University of Michigan, or Hang On Sloopy at the Dread Ohio State and in Columbus, and the pro teams all have their anthems. And, you know, Renegade, the thing I like about Renegade is it's this nice kind of grassroots. Here's this guy who works for the team driving to work one day. Mom was a Styx fan. Wife is a Styx fan. He's listening to Styx's Greatest Hits. He's more of a babe kind of guy. And then Renegade comes on and the light bulb goes off, like, hey, that we could do something here. And he takes it to the game event team, and they create something that's really special. It's probably going to live, I think, for a long, long time.
Yeah, I think that we've seen, certainly in the past few decades, as you say, we have seen obviously music become a bigger and a greater part of these events. Certainly one of the examples that a lot of folks go to that you're going to hear at nearly any sporting event is like Thunderstruck by AC/DC. But I think what I dig about the Renegade thing is, as you say, it's like it's an organic thing that just came up the way that it did and the way that you kind of illustrate and describe that it did in the story. But the other cool thing is, you don't always have a band like Styx that gets behind it. And it's also, I think, kind of sprouted out some other cool things too, because as I was reading your story last night, one of the things I thought about was that one of the things we got out of all this, I think, was the Styx Oh Mama beer. So there's all sorts of stuff that's come out of, as you say, what started as a guy that was like driving to work, listening to Styx on his car stereo and had a thought. And it's just a pretty cool story.
That's the best evolution, where it comes from a lifestyle inspiration and then it becomes lifestyle.
Yeah.
So like you say, it's a beer. It's a moment at a football game. It is, you know, some of the folks in radio in Pittsburgh told me that they know when they play Renegade, there's somebody in their car waving their terrible towel. you know, because nobody in Pittsburgh drives anywhere without a terrible towel. Not if you're a real Pittsburgher. Even if you're a real Pittsburgher living in the diaspora, it's never too far away from you. So now it's a piece of lifestyle.
Before we move on from that, is there anything that you, as you say, you knew the story? Is there anything you learned about the overall story that came as a surprise as you were kind of researching and ferreting this whole thing out?
It was funny hearing Joey Porter Sr. talk about how at least he, for a couple of years, did not know the song's name was Renegade. He always thought it was Oh Mama.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting. I mean, you know, because these guys, their heads are in the game, not in the music that's being played or necessarily music in general. And Styx certainly wasn't the band for a lot of players at that time. You know, these were much younger guys. So yeah, to kind of hear that, and then, oh, you mean it's called Renegade? That's interesting. You know, that was fun.
I did a really interesting exercise the other day. As you mentioned radio, and radio playing that song. And so doing a radio show, it's like there are in any, with any band, they usually call the songs the dirty dozen that they cannot get out of the building without playing. So I've heard all the various songs, whether it's Too Much Time on My Hands, Renegade, Blue Collar Man, and so on, so many times that I don't generally sit there going, wow, you know, I need to put this on and listen to this. But I got, sometimes you get, I have an appreciation for, and this is something I'm going to talk about a little bit later, but just kind of the weird things that we do as music nerds. But one of the things that I've talked about a good amount, I think you and I have talked about this a little bit, but just how, for instance, when box sets first started coming out, they were more, they were curated in a very certain way that feels pretty specific in a way that some box sets don't necessarily feel in the same way when they come out now. And so to that end, there have been many sticks compilations that have come out over the years, but one of the things that came across my desk, or I should say that I have in my collection, that as I was going through boxes looking for something, I came across the original Styx, A&M Styx Classics release. And A&M did this, as you'd be aware, they did this series. Whole series of like classics. They did one for Frampton, all these artists. And so I'm looking at this thing and I'm like, man, I have not, all the Styx compilations I've got, I haven't listened to this forever. So I ripped it into my iTunes and took it for a drive and I hit play. And it's interesting how you can have an exercise like that, that just really kind of, not that I need to have this demonstrated for me, but I was like, man, they have a lot of good songs. And it's like, even though I hear these songs all the time on the radio, as I'm listening to them here in sequence on this compilation, this plays out really well, and I'm not finding myself hitting the skip button for any of these. It's just like, that's the power of those songs, I think, by any band, but in this case, Styx, when you have a song that you've heard a bazillion times, and there I was cranking up Sweet Madam Blue like it was the first time I'd ever heard it, and it's like, those are, it's, I think it's pretty cool that we can still have moments like that as a music fan.
Yeah, when you hear them in that right context, in some cases, unexpected. Yeah. I'll do that with YouTube. I'll have to check something on YouTube. And then when I look on the side, oh, I haven't heard that in a while, or I haven't seen that. And then all of a sudden you're, you know, 2 hours later, it's like MTV, it's like MTV used to be, except you get to choose what's on instead of waiting for MTV to put it on. But you go down that rabbit hole and get to have those experiences and memories again. Which I like to do, and you know, except for at the end of that 2 hours when it's like, oh crap, haven't done this or that yet.
Absolutely, yeah. You look and you're like, oh, I just spent 3 hours, and those 3 hours, they're not coming back. Yeah, for sure.
No, but they were, when you think about it, they were a well spent 3 hours.
Well spent, absolutely. Well, obviously, as music fans, we are sad about the loss of Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead this past weekend, and you have spent a lot of years covering Bob and the music of the Dead, and it's funny because when something like this happens, of course, there's kind of the initial memories that come into your head that, like, I experienced this, I saw that, and I think it's kind of good that we didn't get a chance to talk for a few days, because as the days have passed, like, there's been more things that have kind of come into the frame of my mind, like, you know, oh my God, I saw this, and so it's just the memories, which are always, I think, somewhere kind of there, but when something like this happens, the more you have a chance to kind of just live with the loss, the more, obviously, and I think this is just a natural thing of loss, the more that comes out. Where I wanted to start, Gary, is just as a music fan, how immediately did you get the Dead and kind of understand what they were about?
And I know I've told this story before, but, you know, having a brother, an older brother, 11 and a half years older than me, and a hippie, I was hearing the Grateful Dead when I was 6 years old. And I do have memories of the albums and the covers and the, you know, and of hearing those songs as they came out, and hearing the really weird, trippy, psychedelic stuff, you know, when I was too young to really understand anything other than it was really weird.
Yeah.
And I never got to experience them live, though, until I just never lived anywhere that they habitually played.
Sure.
And even when I came to Detroit, when I first saw them in 1982, out at Pine Knob, it was actually part of a concerted effort on their part to try to break back into Detroit. You know, because Detroit didn't reject them, but didn't embrace them, because this was the city of the MC5 and the Stooges and kick out the Jams, you know, choose your word there. You know, Bob Seger and Ted Nugent and Grand Funk Railroad. This was not the woo-woo psychedelic rock capital of the world. People wanted something that was a little more immediate and a little more raw, and not what the Dead did. So they had, it was interesting. And as a journalist to cover this aspect of it, how they made a real concerted and strategic effort about how they were going to make Detroit a market for them. And so I see them in 82, and, you know, all the Deadheads came and they followed, and, you know, crashed the gate. This was 82. You could still, you know, be a gate crasher and do all the things that were part of Grateful Dead heritage at that time. So that was like a, you know, it was like, you know, cramming a semester class into like a 5-6 hour evening of Dead experience, and learned quite a bit and really appreciated it. You know, up to and including, you know, walking around in the backstage area and hearing rubber hoses snap on skin. you know, we knew we were in the hardcore then.
Yeah, and it's interesting because what I kind of thought of is you were talking about that, them trying to break back into Detroit and all that kind of stuff. How they approached touring as a band felt very strategic in a way that other groups really didn't do. They were not necessarily a band that were like, we're going to go out and play 160 shows in 1983. They really had a strategy. The thing that I think of, and I think it got even more strategic as they got into their later years as a band with Jerry, because I think of, for instance, here in the Cleveland area, they played a couple of shows in March of 1993, one of which got obliterated by a blizzard and did not happen. And then it's like they were back in the area for three more shows in Richfield at the Coliseum that September. So in the pre-internet kind of world, or at least in a world where the internet was not as widespread, you didn't methodically know that you were going to get your dose of the Dead in your city every single year. It might not happen with the Dead. So it's really kind of interesting seeing how the tours kind of developed and snaked out into the touring universe each year based on basically, I think, what they wanted to do or what they didn't want to do. So they were just a very interesting organization in that way and a lot of other ways, I think.
And they were all, this was one of the first bands that was all about fan service. You know,
the mail order ticketing, for one.
Right. Yeah, the way they did their ticketing, the way they did their merch, the Shakedown Street, the pre-concert scene, everything that was, they embraced the idea that they were a culture and figured out a way to use that in a business sense, in a way that sort of worked for everybody. You know, you knew how to get your tickets, you knew the backdoor ways to get in if you didn't necessarily have a ticket. The whole tape trading aspect of Dead culture, and then later that they internalized themselves to become with the Dick's Picks and then and all of those series. They were you know, for this utopian hippie collective, they became a very Byzantine kind of business model.
Yeah, and it, as you kind of allow, it served them well in a number of ways, be it Dick's Picks, be it everything else that came out as far as their ongoing official way that they issue and reissue shows. All that starts because of what they allowed and what they cultivated with the whole tape trading culture. But also, I was listening, Dean Del Rey was talking on his podcast last night. He did a whole episode on Bob Weir and the passing, and one of the benefits of the way they embraced the whole tape trading thing the way they did, he said, was that as fans, we can now sit and basically listen to any Dead show. Whatever your Dead show is that you were at, largely it exists. And in a lot of cases, Gary, as you know, it exists in soundboard quality. So you can hear that show that you were at in a pristine fashion. And as a music nerd, that was something for me that really early on, and obviously Bruce Hornsby has his ties to the Dead, played with the Dead and Bob, and just, you know, Jerry played on his records. And so, but when I went to see Bruce Hornsby in 1993, and I don't know, I was not as directly wired into the trading culture in that moment. So I think it was at least a few years later when I really did get into bootlegs, hardcore, and all that kind of stuff. I was thrilled to find that there was a soundboard copy of the nearly 3 hours that Bruce and his band played at Music Hall, you know, here in Cleveland on that particular night, that was in existence. And so I think they opened an important door about preserving your history, that there's a lot of folks that I think took notice of the importance of that. And I think certainly there are those that, you know, maybe did not do that, that are now looking at what bands like the Dead did, and they're going, man, I wish we would have recorded some of those key shows and key tours back in the 70s and 80s and so on. So it's really, like I said, at the top of this particular part of things, it ultimately serves them well, because they now have an aspect of their business that is all around. Like, now you can buy the, I think it kind of started, I don't know, 10 years ago, however long ago that was, when they put out the entire Europe 72 run. You yep. no longer just have the Europe 72 album. Now you can buy the entire tour. So obviously they've maximized that to good effect, where it's like they've rolled out other further tours where it's like you can buy the entire tour, you can buy the entire run, or this entire set. So again, as somebody that, once I'm a fan of your band or a fan of the artist or whatever, I want to consume as much of it as possible. You're right with something you said a while ago, just about how they really were servicing the fans early on. They really, if you're a complete music nerd for the Grateful Dead, they're your band. It's, I don't think that we're, I think I could spend all my time listening to Dead music and still have other stuff to discover, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I love the level of scholarship that exists in Dead fandom.
Yeah.
And especially when it comes to the live show, because Pete, you will talk to somebody who's a Deadhead, who's a truly devoted fan, and they can tell you the first time they played that song, the only time they ever put these two songs together, the, you know, when this, you know, when this song, it's, there's so much scholarship. I call it scholarship, because every, you know, the real diehards know what happened, when it happened, why it was special, why it wasn't. You know, I'm always going on some of the, you know, some of, in fact, I have cousins out in, you know, in Marin County who are Deadheads. And it's like, okay, so which, you know, if I'm only going to listen to one or two Dick's Picks, which one do I want to get? And then you get not a single show, you get the playlist of, well, you got to listen to this from Hampton, Virginia, and this, you know, this from St. Louis, and this one from Sacramento, and that they know all that stuff. I'm a little like that with some bands, but not nearly the depth that you get from the Grateful Dead community.
What's a band that you're like that with?
I can be like that with Springsteen.
Yeah.
You know, we have to remember too, there are a good number of them, but there are not a ton of bands that do what the Dead did and have shows that are that different and introduces songs and material that you're only going to hear them do once or twice. I mean, we, you know, God love our friend Styx, who we started this talking about, the entire Styx tour from 1987 or something is not going to land the same way the entire Dead tour, you know, from Europe 72 or North America 94 is going to land, or Springsteen, you know, any of his years. It's just not the same. So it's really about finding those bands that do something different almost every night and find a way to have something special be part of their shows.
Yeah, I think that's what's interesting about your list of Dead songs that you wrote for Ultimate Classic Rock that went up yesterday is one of the songs that I came across early on that's part of your top 10. But early on, as I was kind of going back into my dead memory banks as the news of Weir's passing was circulating was I started thinking about just random records, but one of them was In the Dark. And so as I'm in my In the Dark kind of submersion, that brings me, of course, to My Brother Esau, which you have at number 10 on your list. And that's a B-side. And there are songs, whether it is that or like Touch of Grey, they were playing Touch of Grey before it ever made it onto In the Dark. So that's when you talk about the tours and how you can really kind of, unlike some other bands and artists where the tours are perhaps more uniform show to show to show, the Dead, you really could see some interesting things develop. And it's like, you could see how that they played Touch of Grey when they first played it and what it sounded like a year or two later when they were playing it and how it further developed by the time it made on the record. So that's what's pretty fascinating, is that even the songs that maybe were well established, that were on records and firmly in the catalog, all their stuff kind of evolved in really interesting ways over the years as they were playing shows based on kind of where their heads were at and what they were into musically. It was ever kind of shifting and evolving, and I really kind of appreciate that about the music of the Dead as well.
Well, when we talk about Bobby, you look at something like his first solo album, Ace,
yeah,
was comprised almost entirely of songs that the Dead had been playing already. Yeah. And then he went in and he recorded them as his solo album, but he had a chance to road test all these songs and whip them into a kind of shape that he would want to put them on record. And you have that with Jerry's records, couple of Mickey's records. And then, of course, certainly with the Dead's record, there's usually a trail of history for all these songs that are part of the albums that dates back. I mean, Touch of Grey was what, 6-7 years before the album
82
came
or
out.
So.
Yeah. I mean, so that, that's a fascinating part of it. And again, you don't get very many bands who do that. Even some of the jam bands, they don't necessarily do that. The songs come out once they've been on record, but the Dead certainly always did that. Springsteen has a history of having done that a lot of, early on, especially in the 70s. A lot of what appeared on The River or on Darkness, mm-hmm. He was playing in shows already leading into that. And that's a special, to me, that's a special thing for a fan when you're hearing something that they haven't committed to record yet. I remember with the Dead, they used to play A Long Way to Go Home for years, and it never really made an official album. It made that kind of posthumous collection of, here's the stuff we were working on. But I always thought that was a killer song, and gee, that would have some commercial potential too, but the Dead being the Dead, it never managed to get onto an actual album.
It's really interesting too, how Ace, it's a Bob Weir solo album, but you've got virtually most of the Dead on that record. So it's really, right. And as you say, they had been playing those songs and that kind of, so it's just, there's some things like that if you would have been in a group and taken that and put that stuff out as your solo record, I mean, it helps obviously that he had guys from the band playing on it, but there's other bands that could have broken up a band.
Right.
You taking these songs out of the band setting and going, oh, I'm actually going to put these on my solo record. Screw you guys.
they had that, obviously they had that kind of spirit of counterculture, hippiedom.
Sure.
And later great passive aggressive behavior towards each other.
Of course.
When it came to all that. But it, it was certainly in their earliest days, at least through the 70s, that was one of the hallmarks of the Grateful Dead, and the Grateful Dead as a band community as well as a fan community.
I appreciated you sharing audio of an interview that you had done with Bob in 2009 for our radio show, and it was interesting listening to that. And I mentioned this to you in email, but it was interesting hearing Bob talk about how he said, I know that a lot of people perceive that Jerry was the leader of the Grateful Dead, but he's like, there really was, and you were kind of asking him in a sense about who was kind of the musical director in The Grateful Dead, who's the musical director in any situation. And he was basically saying there is no musical director in the things that I do. And he explained why, and he really, you know, just made it sound very collaborative, which we know it was, and all that kind of stuff. And if I want to take a solo, I take a solo. And if so-and-so wants to take a solo, they take a solo, and so on. And it really kind of got me thinking, because I think that if you would have asked me who the leader or leaders in the Grateful Dead were, I probably would have said Jerry and Bob. And, you know, the more that I've come to know about the Dead over the years, it's like, obviously, Phil wields a strong influence. And I think that Mickey also, you know, wields a strong influence in that whole story. Just generally, though, how true do you think that is when Bob says something like that, that there was no, you know, kind of leader in the Grateful Dead? Do you think that's correct? Because as we know, you and I talk to folks that will say something that you're like, that's what you believe, and you've explained it well, so I understand why you feel that way, but I don't think the fan base feels that way. So, and I'm not saying the fan base doesn't feel that way about the Dead, but it just was an interesting thing to hear Bob say it that way.
I think, and what I took from that, I think what he was really saying was, in the moment, there's not necessarily a leader of the Dead. So when we're cooking into the 20th minute of the other one or something like that, you know, they did have the great gift of listening to each other as musicians. And so, and they could hear the song going one way or another, or they could hear Bob throw out a lick, almost as kind of a suggestion, like, hey guys, how about this? And they could hear it at that moment, and everybody would kind of follow, you know, yes, sure, go and do that. So I think on stage, they were a greater democracy, with the caveat that Jerry Garcia would be the one to bring the hammer down. Not all the time. And in the later years, that was not necessarily the case. But for the most part, Jerry would be the parent, you know, to let the kids run around and play, and finally say, hey, time for dinner, come on in, and then bring it home. You know, in terms of setting the tone for the night, while he was alive, I think it was Garcia, you know, certainly I would say at least through 94 and probably into 95. I'm not entirely sure what kind of shape he was in at the end of that tour in the summer, to exert that kind of, yeah, you hate to call it control, because it's not absolute control. His was definitely a benign leadership, but he certainly had the vision, saw the framework, and dictated that to the band. And then within that, and certainly in the moment, there was a lot of room for everybody to be the leader for 2, 3, 5, 10, you know, minutes, depending on how the song was going to go. And then, you know, this is the great story of the Grateful Dead afterwards, is the power vacuum. And how it was filled.
Yeah, and just generally, Jerry and Bob as guitar players, I think they're almost kind of one of the underrated guitar player duos out there. Like, they had some really interesting musical conversations as players, and I think that they each brought interesting things to the music of the Dead, with the style of the way they played. And one thing that I saw was, I saw Bob's playing described in, might have been the piece that Stephen Hyden wrote for The Ringer, but just called his playing eccentric in a way that it caused a lot of conflict for a period of time within the Dead. So I think that is how bands are, as you know, is that there are different stylings that come together to form the overall musical stew. And sometimes one of those elements is far enough to the left that it takes a while for the rest of the band to come around and go, we're okay with. And sometimes that's an evolutionary process where the guitar player in this case starts out one way and kind of just keeps pushing the boat further and further and further away from the dock. And they're like, you're pretty far away from the dock at this point, and we don't love it. And so in this case, if Weir got the boat far away from the dock and they had some sort of issue with it at any point, obviously, ultimately, they saw the light and they were like, oh, this does work. And now we see how this works. And they kind of, they fit with that ultimately. But I think it's really interesting. You know, this is a completely different group, but another group that I always loved was Pat and Jim with the Smithereens and the dynamic that they had. And I think that that's something that certainly I discovered as a music fan, is that, like, it's pretty fascinating when you have these two guitar bands. I mean, obviously we can say Judas Priest, we can keep going, but there's an interesting thing that happens when you have two guys, but more importantly, two guys that are different, that really contribute something important. And I think that Bob was the very important yin to Jerry's yang in the case of the Grateful Dead, right?
And what's most interesting about you, yes, and what's most interesting about that too is they were both insatiable students.
Yes.
They never ever stopped, you know, Bob right up to, you know, what he was doing, you know, last year. Insatiable students finding new things and then trying to apply them would be the nice term, force them would be the accurate term into what they did, you know, with the Dead and did together. That was a band that probably could have done with some rehearsing, even though
sure.
lack of rehearsing was part of the magic too. But, you know, so they tended to surprise each other maybe more than they necessarily had to. If they had even taken, like, okay, let's rehearse the day before we go on tour and gotten a sense about where their heads were at and what they had learned since the last time they were together. I talked to Jorma Kekkonen last month from, you know, Jefferson Airplane and Hot mm-hmm. Tuna about the different Bay Area guitar players. And he told me that he, when he was talking about Bobby, that, you know, he said that, you know, Bobby went and studied with Reverend Gary Davis. And he said, Bobby's chord shapes were different than anything anybody had ever seen. And even though they made great sounds, you know, and then to come out of to take those chord shapes and for the band to find a way inside those chords, first of all, their chord shapes, they don't even know, but then mm-hmm. to find a way for the band to work within those chord shapes was part of the fascination, the challenge, and the frustration of the Grateful Dead. And Bobby and Jerry kept doing that throughout. They'd always find some new idea, some new influence, some new guru, you know, instrumental guru or teacher, and then come back and apply it to the Dead. And then when you're fundamentally talking about bandmates who are a rhythm section, albeit not a conventional rhythm section, but they're trying to lock in a groove and lock in an arrangement, and you got these two guitar players just throwing haymakers at him, you know, from all sides. That's the tension. That's the great tension of the Grateful Dead. And when it worked, when they were all able to embrace the tension and see a way through, it was where the magic was. When they couldn't, was where the train wreck was.
Yeah, the Dead took a lot of shit from people who did not get it. It was, in one sense, I think, a different variation of all the negativity that members of the Monkees had to work past with the Monkees. It was, with the Monkees, they weren't even a real band, and so on. With the Dead, I sent this to you, but you got that Hard Times article, classic headline from 2019. We ranked every Grateful Dead album. They all came in last.
Right.
And that's a funny headline, but that's one thing that I kind of appreciate about the Dead fan base, which you spoke to a little bit here, is that they did not hold these guys up as being perfect. There is certainly Deadhead worship, no doubt, but like a baseball or football team, Deadheads always seem to be pretty honest, even in pre-internet times, about the shows that were great and the shows where they kind of fell on their face as a live band. And you and I both, like, we have seen shows from both of these guys that fell into both of those categories.
Oh, absolutely. And then I think the Deadhead community, though, embraces the train wrecks as much as they embrace the brilliance.
Yeah.
I mean, the train wrecks are what allowed the brilliance to shine brighter when it happens. And I think the great frustration in the last few years of the Dead was the brilliance wasn't happening as often as everybody wanted it to, and maybe than it had before. And that's about, you know, obviously it was about health and about, you know, about interpersonal relationships within the band and thing, you know, things that had changed there. But, you know, if you saw a bad, you know, there were bad Dead shows, and then there were those great bad Dead shows where you remember them. You know, you remember what went wrong, and you remember how, you know, and you embrace these guys as human beings, and you appreciate that, okay, we did go, you know, use your term, they did go too far from shore to really bring it back. But I think that fan base and really music appreciators, and this happens a lot in jazz, is you can, you know, you really do appreciate the attempt and the effort that they're making to then get to that point of brilliance that'll be well worth whatever else you have to sit through.
Yeah, I think that's what's kind of fun as a music fan, if you do have kind of that jazz kind of sense of appreciation, is that if they do fail, you can go, well, they didn't get there, but I see what they're going for. And I hope that they're going to do this again in another show, because I would love to see them, what I watched them try to pull off tonight, I would love to see them pull that off in another show, and I think they will. So those are the cool moments. You know, when you and I were emailing, you mentioned a 94 show that was particularly one that you enjoyed to the point that you went to hunt down a copy of it. In your memory, and we all have shows like this, but in your memory, what was it about that night that really stayed with you in a way that you're like, I want to have a copy of this to be able to go back to this? What was it about that particular show that was so up there?
So this was July 31st, 1994, Palettes of Auburn Hills in suburban Detroit. And they came out with Touch of Grey, opening song, Never a Bad Way to Start the Evening. And they were just on. I mean, you could tell, you could even see that they were locked in. Something was going on that they knew. You know, they knew what they wanted to do. They were in step with each other. They were enjoying hearing each other. It was visible as well as audio. And then, you know, they just worked through the night, you know, feeling good. They were feeling good. They were feeling inside the music, and they were able to bring the audience into the music with them, which is very wooey wooey, but that's what the Grateful Dead was on a good night. Everybody was existing within the music, and, you know, great set list. We got The Greatest Story Ever Told, a Bobby song they played, you know, got a lot of good covers, Spoonful and Me and My Uncle, Midnight Hour, which was a lot of fun to hear, Rolling Stones The Last Time. It just was one of those nights. They finished with The Wait. And so, yeah, when I was afterwards, I asked Dennis McNally, you know, I said, any way you can, you know, grab me a recording of this at some point. And he looked at me, cause I never asked for anything like that before, but I really felt like that was, you know, I felt like I had hit the, you know, dead terra firma that night. And then, yeah, about a month or so later, a couple cassettes arrived, and I still have them, still nice to have. And it's not a show that I've seen out there a lot. So it's kind of nice to be able to, you know, toss that in every now and then and remember that night.
You write in your article of these 10 Bob Weir songs, you say the Dead was, as we know, a reluctant studio band and not one for hit singles. And that kind of goes into something that I was thinking about, was how they had just this knack for fitting in interesting ways with the times. And one thing that came to mind specifically in that way was Shakedown Street in the disco era.
Right.
So
I don't know if I call that fitting in. they attempted to be part of it. And, you know, people have, this is a polarizing part, of course, of Dead history. And that was one I always say, it was like, that was all right, but why? You know, you guys, that lane's covered. It's well covered. You know, they don't need the Grateful Dead to be part of, this. Go do your thing. You know, do what you do, or find that next thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it that was one part of their history that did not really work for me, even though some of the music was kind of okay.
I think it was just funny because that song, Shakedown Street, becomes kind of a fan favorite, but they don't play it in that disco-y kind of way as the years progress. And so they put out a playlist back around Christmas that's on Apple Music and some other places, that one of the things that's on that playlist is a version of Shakedown Street from Oakland, I think, in 1979. And so you're listening to that and you're getting Shakedown Street in its full disco glory. So it'd been a while since I'd heard it in that way. I was like going, man, I'm like that. So it's just really interesting to hear it in that context. So there's that. And is it interesting to you? I think that the Moody Blues did this in almost more of a natural way that was still surprising, but what the Moody Blues did musically throughout the 80s was very interesting, and they have their entire like second wave that I don't think people would have predicted that. But is it interesting to you how radio and fans and everybody grabbed onto Touch of Grey? What do you think that was about?
I think it was just a really good song.
It's a great song.
I mean, and it hit an audience, a rock audience, at a certain point in their lives where they were just starting to get that touch of gray in their hair and feel that touch of gray in their life. So they really reacted to what they were saying in that song and what it was about. And you lock that in with a really good song and some great guitar stuff. And let's not forget a wonderful video. That brought it to people who never would have listened to a Grateful Dead song. And you had this wonderful alchemy, not unlike San Carlos Santana and Smooth and Supernatural at that time. You had this great alchemy of things coming together to elevate that beyond the core audience.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I think that you hear the story of various songs that, as soon as a band or an artist came up with a song, somebody in the room or somebody in the band said, that's a hit. And I don't think that you don't have that's a hit kind of thought when you hear some of the early live versions of them playing Touch of Grey before it made it to album. It's not this thing that you're going, oh man, it was right there. There was something that happened the way that was recorded and the way it was produced. And of course the way they recorded the whole In the Dark album, recording it in a venue, you know, without people, you know, basically in their natural, regular environment on stage. I think that certainly contributes a lot to it, but it's just you're right. I mean, the video was one of the first things that I thought of that, like, I know that the video, you know, drew me in because just it's kind of a funny video. And as you say, it's a great song, but there's a lot of things that came together, a lot of magic that came together to really deliver a song that still, when you hear that on the radio today, like it still sounds, you just still feel happy when you hear that song on the radio. And the other song that is weird specific is, I think that, I think Hell in a Bucket is a lot better than people give that song credit for being. It's a great Dead rocker, and you don't necessarily have the idea. You don't sit there going, oh man, Dead rocker, but that's a great, great, it's a very weird tune. Like it's got some weird like sound effects and stuff throughout the song, but it's a cool song.
No, it very much is. And that's the one that seems to get the Bobby song that seems to get talked about the most from In the Dark. I'm partial, and I included it on the UCR list, Throwing Stones. I think is the better song. It's a really clever, inventive kind of song, and there's, you know, I just love all the sonic touches and the guitar weave in there, and I particularly like how, you know, when they're getting into the foreboding, very serious parts of the song, you know, Mickey Hart and Bill Kreutzmann just start playing this tribal war drums, you know, the thing that leads into ashes all fall down, and you really get the sense of, okay, the songs, the lyrics sense of, okay, we are, you know, we're the kids are dancing and, you know, and twirling and, you know, throwing their bones. But by the way, the politicians are throwing bones that hurt. They're throwing stones. Yeah. And, you know, so I really thought that was a song that just put it the sonic, you know, put together the sonics with the sentiment. And that was the other thing about, you know, is the dead, the dead goes on tangents. We can too. They were gifted with a couple of lyricists in Hunter and Barlow, mm-hmm. who knew exactly what the Grateful Dead should be singing about. They too felt and understood the audience connection. And they knew that this is, you know, Touch of Grey. This is what the Grateful Dead should be singing about right now. You know, and throughout their career, you know, the music never stopped. All these, playing in the band, they understood that relationship and why these would be highly credible songs for the Dead to sing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It starts with a band being open to having outside collaborators like that, but for the Dead, it was so key. They didn't need to be propped up. They were great songwriters, but man, just the magic that we got because they were open to working with John and working with Robert. I mean, the proof is right there in the songs. And I liked reading, I kind of forgot about this. I forget which song it was exactly, but you know, these guys were like brothers. They had arguments and stuff like that, but that extended to Robert as well. Robert and Weir had some sort of disagreement that he objected so much to whatever the changes were that, you know, that Bob had made lyrically to the song they're working on, that he said to Bob, take my name off of the song. So I like that they had those kind of conversations that didn't take some other situations that might take Robert Hunter out of the Grateful Dead circle from that point forward. It didn't. But they agreed to disagree on that particular in that particular moment, you know?
Yeah, that was One More Saturday Night.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, I mean, they were, you know, that some of that is hippie think. You know, if you want to call it that, or if you just want to call it enlightenment. They were enlightened in dealing with each other, even though eventually they became kind of grizzled old guys. Who had to tell each other to get off each other's lawn. They certainly, during most of the Dead's history, they really dealt with each other on an enlightened kind of level. And it really was all about the greater good of the Grateful Dead for them.
Did you have fun putting together this list? Because I think you and I kind of share a similar view on lists like this, in that it's not the 10 most obvious songs. You mentioned throwing stones. I think that you're good when you do a list about this list like this, about throwing some relative obscurities at them. I love, for instance, that you had Little Star on your list. So there's like some really fun stuff to dig into on this list. And so it must have been kind of fun for you as a fan, kind of going back to, you know, some of these songs that you maybe hadn't thought about for a minute.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but you go through it's almost like a grieving process when you jump into these, and you have to do you have to do it quickly, but you start to think about, okay, what's the coolest? What makes me look, you know, the best or the nerdiest? Yeah. And you go through all that, and finally you just have to say, screw it. What are the 10? Just put them, just write them down and then write about them. And don't look at anything. Don't second guess yourself. These are them. And I'm going to plant the flag here. And, you know, cause even you get to the end of a list and you're like, well, maybe I should have put in, no, shut up. Stop. You're there. This is going to be it. And we're staying with it. And that's the process. So, you know, you slap yourself upside the head a little bit, and there are worse things to have to torture yourself about than the 10 favorite than the 10 best songs of any given artist.
Isn't it cool what he got into with Don Was, with the Wolf Brothers in these final years? Like, you talked about how Bob took something inspirationally from Reverend Gary Davis that ended up being crucial for him as a guitar player. You talked about how both Bob and Jerry were continuing students, and that's something that I've heard it, and you've heard it too from Bruce Hornsby, who calls himself a lifelong student of music. And I would place Don Was in that category of, he is going to ongoing university as well. You would not think on the surface, if you're kind of more of a casual music fan, that Don Was would still have things that he's learning, but I know when I spoke to him in 2022 as the Wolf Brothers, I mean, they were, you know, a few years into doing that, but basically one of the things that he said that he really had learned through playing with Bob was he's like, I'm learning with each show how I can play less. He's like, I'm playing this much less, but then he's like, I realized that I can play even this much more or less. And so he really took an interesting ride with Bob, and it's really, that shows you, I think, the kind of artist that Bob was, that Bob Weir was, that somebody like Don can go into that experience and really come out of it having had such a revelatory time playing those shows.
And Bob learning as much from that experience, you know, himself finding ways to play, you know, because those shows were made up so much of the Dead repertoire. And I remember sitting, I saw them, the Wolf Brothers, several times, and sitting there thinking, like, he's really relaxed with this stuff now. Okay. Yeah. Whereas the Dead, you would have the full on attack, and he's up there just kind of, he's finding this very easy, relaxed way to play these songs that allows so much music into it. And that's what allowed them to have the Wolf Pack, to have the horns, to bring Jeff in on keyboards and occasional other people, and to really turn Wolf Brothers into its own kind of lab. And then when you would juxtapose a Wolf Brothers show to a Dead and Company show, and you know the difference was right there in front of you, both great. Both really enjoyable, but very, very different. And nice to see that the same song could work in both settings. I think the one thing I'm sorry about is Wolf Brothers they never really hit the studio to do some Wolf Brothers songs. It would have been really, I'm not going to go to awesome yet, but it would have been interesting, certainly. And it may well have been awesome, you know, especially when you got a guy like Don in there with his producers, to put his producer's hat on, and you know, and really sonically and spiritually turn whatever they would have created into something, you know, that would have been special in its own right.
Just generally, is there an album that you've been listening to? Is there an album that, you know, what do you kind of go back to generally from Bob Weir, from the Grateful Dead? If somebody's looking to find their way into the music of this band, what's the gateway?
The best answer, of course, is that with the Dead is there are gateways, you know, and it really is very, very plural. So, I mean, you know, you could, if somebody wants a micro, you know, if somebody wants an instantly satisfying experience, you know, then you do send them to something like Two in the Dark. If somebody wants, you know, would want a period, you know, experience, maybe you do send them to Anthem of the Sun or Axiom, whatever, you know, the third album, you know, or Live Dead, or, you know, if they want a very earthy experience, we've got Working Man's Dead and American Beauty. If you want a what the hell experience, you know, then from the Mars Hotel or Blues for Allah, you know, there are so many different places to send people that it becomes the challenge to say, okay, who's this person I'm recommending this music to, and where do I think would be the best gateway for them, and then let them find their journey in the Dead. Do you want to listen to American Beauty and then get more psychedelic, so Anthem of the Sun, or do you want to go in on the crowd pleaser In the Dark, and then which path do I take you to from In the Dark? I hope that doesn't sound too much like a cop out, but they're an awful hard band, other than taking a live recording, to say, okay, here's your Grateful Dead 101. And even then, it's hard to pick that live recording.
They really are. It's interesting the way I kind of found my way to different songs from the Dead, even as I was hearing them. Sometimes you, Gary, as you know, sometimes you hear a song in a certain environment and it just presents it to you in a new way. And, you know, one thing that I heard was I went to see Blue Rodeo play a week's worth of shows in the 90s in Toronto at Massey Hall. And that was the first time I'd gone to see a band play, you know, a series of shows like that all in a row. And each night their walk-on music was Uncle John's band. And I was just sitting there in the seats and I'm like, how perfect is that? And so that made me think, as I was thinking about that, what that made me think about was obviously there's the dedicated, you know, compilation, which I mentioned to you in email. And you know, I loved Indigo Girls' versions. I loved their version of Uncle John's band on that. And that made me think about how the first time, even though I'd heard the song, the way that I came to appreciate Romeo and Juliet was hearing Indigo Girls do it versus Dire Straits. Although now I love the Dire Straits version to pieces. So that's, I think, the interesting thing. The reason I bring all that up, Los Lobos did a great version of Bertha. Something else that I was thinking of outside of the Dead was going to see the Mavericks a few years back. And they, of course, are just great interpreters of songs, and very sad news that we lost Raul recently. But this particular show, I still am looking, and they've put out some live recordings, but I still have not found a live recording that has it. But on that night, they did a great version of Harvest Moon, which that's out there on some various things. But they also did Us and Them by Pink Floyd, that was just a transcendent version that I haven't been able to find that officially on anything. And the whole point of everything is that, especially as we know today, because we hear it, like when you're talking to like somebody like Kevin Cronin or any of these classic rock bands, is that you have all these people that it's pretty fascinating to think about the first time that they're hearing a song like, say, Keep on Loving You by REO, but also like going to see the Mavericks. Maybe this is the first time that that person, the younger kid or teenager or whatever, has heard Us and Them. Maybe that's how they discover Pink Floyd. So Grateful Dead seem to be a band more than some, as I was thinking about just all the cover versions that are out there. There's some really interesting gateways to the Dead to be found in that way, you know? So
yeah, you can do that with Bob Dylan, yeah, too. There's a lot of that. There's some of that with Neil Young as well, Joni Mitchell, you know, but that's when you know that when we think about who the important artists are, they're the ones who've inspired other artists to do their songs on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And that's very, you know, and the Dead certainly has that.
Well, Gary, I think we've gone on plenty of tangents, as you said. I think we've covered plenty of tangents, but we've left folks hopefully with some stuff to listen to, some homework, but always good to chop it up musically with you, man. Thank you for taking some time
here. You too. My pleasure.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.